Good morning and welcome to Jew in the City Speaks with your host, Allison Josephs, also known as Jew in the City. We've been talking a lot about Israel and anti-Semitism on this show of late. And the truth is that while there is still a lot to deal with there and still a lot of trauma that the Israeli people are facing and basically multiple blood libels popping up every day, that's not all that the Jewish world is facing. You know, the interesting thing about there being a big event is that in the middle of big events, there's also all the things that were going on before. For instance, during COVID, while everybody was having their various crises around that, our Mako members, which is the division of Jew in the City that deals with former and questioning Haredi Jews looking for a positive place within the Jewish community, they were going through all the stuff they were going through before, but now with COVID as an overlay. Same thing with October 7th, all the crises that we're experiencing because of October 7th. There are people experiencing whatever they were going through before plus October 7th and some things totally not related. So we have a branch of the organization outside of our media arm, outside of our Makom arm called Tikkun. And Tikkun means to repair. And Tikkun basically came about after hearing Mako members talk about the things that went wrong in their lives, the things that pushed them out of the community. I started keeping track of what was going wrong, first for my own mental health. And at a certain point, I realized that I was seeing a pattern to what was going wrong. And it was also, not coincidentally, the same thing that was creating the negative headlines in fictional and news media. And so I wondered, would there be a way for us to, behind the scenes, working with insiders and experts, help to alleviate the issues that were pushing people away and creating Chil Hashem, or when I grew up as a non-observant Jew, we called it a shanda, an embarrassment for the Jewish people. And so a big part of what we've been doing now with Tikkun is looking for experts in the side, the community, who are creating positive change. And someone that we've connected with recently who is working in the Aguna space, and for anyone that is not familiar with that word, Aguna is the term of a woman who is in a chained marriage. There's complicated laws when it comes to getting divorced, according to Jewish law, and it can leave women who are abused by their husbands stuck in a dead marriage. And so Kayla Haber-Goldstein is working on some innovative solutions in this space. And so she has caught our attention as a change maker from within. And I'm delighted to have her on our show today.
Hey, thank you.
And so, Kayla, you started an organization called Questioning the Answers, which exists as an Instagram platform, but you're currently turning it into a 501c3. Is that correct?
It actually started as a book that turned into events, that turned into an Instagram platform, now it's becoming a 501c. Yeah.
Amazing. So tell us about your background growing up Jewishly and what caused you to start this Questioning the Answers movement.
So I grew up Haredi in Israel, the daughter of a pretty big rabbi. And I grew up kind of without questioning anything just because it wasn't really something that we did. And when I moved to America, I was a new mom, just married, and I didn't have the community around me that was like expecting me to be a certain way. And I stopped being the way that they wanted me to because the only reason I was doing it was community. And then when I had my second son, it was a very, very difficult birth and postpartum, and I was just very angry in general. And I started looking for answers to my questions. So while I had questions for a few years, it took me a life break, some kind of mental breakdown to actually go out and find the answers. And once I started finding them, I was very, very surprised by what I found. It was just our heritage and our religion is like so rich and so beautiful. And there's so much there, and there's so much nuance and movement and spectrum, and you can really find your place. And I really thought that I was the only one. But when I started talking to my friends and talking to other people, I realized that a lot of people felt very trapped and stuck by how they were raised. And they didn't realize that they can go and find their own place in Judaism. And there's so much more beauty than what they were told.
Well, it sounds, you keep saying finding your place. It sounds a lot like the Makom journey that we're trying to assist people that come from a similar background. So I love that, you know, sort of delving in and getting a chance to experience the sources from a place of nuance and depth, and without that outside expectation or pressure, you can see the beauty of it, because that's really what That's what made me start Jew in the City in the first place, that I had not seen the beauty in an observant life, in a traditional life as a secular Jew. I got to experience it for myself, and I felt like, well, all these other secular Jews don't know what they're missing either. And then I discovered the people raised like you, raised in the system, but with something missing. And the word tikkun, the other, branch of our organization, means to repair. So let me ask you, what got broken so that we need to do this repair? What happened along the way so that people can experience Jewish texts and traditions as they were meant to be, with the richness and the fullness, as opposed to what's missing that you and your friends were raised with?
So what happened, this is my philosophy, but it's based on a ton of research. I think what happened was is that as time went on, we really assimilated. We were in a lot of trouble. Like, a lot of people tried to kill us, and there was a very big element of fear. So originally we had these like giant leaders and sages, and they would sit all day and they would talk and they would come up with things. And it was a very like fluid, beautiful, warm religion. But as time went on, people got more and more afraid to make change, and more afraid to discuss, and more fear and control, because they were afraid of assimilation, until eventually got to a point where, right before the Holocaust, we had the reform movement got started, and I'm blanking on
Enlightenment.
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 Sorry, I'm Israeli, so sometimes English leaves me. The Enlightenment period, and we lost a lot of Jews, and then the Holocaust came, and the reaction that everyone had was just to freeze. Like, we're not changing anything, we're not evolving anymore, we're not doing anything, we're not teaching anything. And women especially were like kind of just pushed to the side. All education went out the window. Any type of transmission that went from mother to daughter was finished, because there was almost no generational link anymore. And while the rest of the world moved on and women went to college, our world didn't. And that created kind of this like weird situation where women had the ability to learn but weren't given the opportunity to learn. Sarah Schneer came and she tried to fix that, and she did a huge, huge, huge job, and she's one of my biggest role models. But at the end of the day, we still have this kind of like this difference between men and women, where like men are allowed to like go and learn and discuss and decide where they want to be, but women have to be how they were raised. And I think that that's where the thing is missing. And the beauty that I had was that once I got permission to learn, because I was married, so I didn't have to risk it all, I was able to learn, and my husband didn't care. And he was like, "Do your thing. I'm so proud of you." I really found something so beautiful. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, we need to share this. We need to show everyone. Like, girls need to learn. We need to learn."
So I want to clarify that you're referring to the Haredi world as opposed to the modern Orthodox world, which I think did have a different pathway, and has had more female learning, I think, for since its founding, which also I think kind of came after the Enlightenment. The other thing that I think is so interesting about people's experience is that I would talk to Mako members, and the male members would say that they had less freedom than the women. And I do think that there are patterns that we can find. And I also think that whatever people are raised in kind of feels like that's the thing. And then someone else could be having an experience down the block, and that's their worldview, and that's all they know. And you don't know, I'm not sure if you've experienced that before, but I have had Mako members where the guys will tell me the women have it so much better, the women will tell me the men have it so much better. And I think it can in some ways go family to family, or yeshiva versus school. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, but I even in my organization, where now we have events and Shabbatons, and I just talk to people all day, and I do online chavrusas, and we do classes. We have people from every background, like modern Orthodox, Hasidish, Haredi, converts, like literally completely unaffiliated. We literally have all backgrounds, and every single person, in however they were raised, they're kind of expected to be like their parents. Whatever it is, however they were raised, they're expected to be like their parents, and they don't really have that freedom to go and explore it for themselves and find their own place. So some people that grew up modern Orthodox became Hasidish, and some people that grew up Hasidish became just regular like Litvish, and some people, like, everybody just kind of became their own thing. I grew up Haredi Litvish, and I became like Mizrahi Baal Shem Tov. Like, it doesn't make any sense. There's no, and that's the beauty of it, that everybody finds where they're going to end up.
So what I would also say is that, and obviously there are exceptions to every rule, but another pattern that I've discovered in Macomb is that it's in the places where the kids feel like they have less ability to ask the questions and, buck the trend, that they probably want to rebel more. That in the homes where there is more permission to say, I hate this. I disagree with this. Why do we do this? That's so dumb. I'll give you an example for one of my sons. Unexpectedly, at around 11 years old, I got several times from him coming to me in tears. Why did I have to be born Jewish? I wish I was born an atheist. It's so hard to be born a Jewish. And it was a little bit surprising, I have to say. I was like, this is not how I planned this. And I told him the true answer, which is that you're my baby. We will love you no matter what. Nothing will ever change that. So while you're being raised in this house, you are going to a Jewish school. We are doing Shabbos. We are doing these Jewish things. But when you get older, you'll make your own decisions. And nothing that you could do could break that bond. And he needed to hear me say that several times to just reassure him that the love was unconditional. And when his bar mitzvah rolled around, he decided that he wanted to now do these things and lean into this identity for himself because he was choosing it. But I had given him the permission to not. And I think by having that permission to go differently and know that love is unconditional, it made all the difference. And I think another piece when you describe the trauma of what happened in Jewish history is that we stopped having homes, as many homes with secure attachment, where children were able to express their emotions and feel seen, held, heard. And it's not because anybody tried to do the wrong thing. It's because there was deep trauma in the family. There was, you know, deaths, there were massacres, there were awful things that befell the Jewish people. And unfortunately, unhealthy patterns, you know, came out of that. So you seem like you're dealing with a sort of a bigger issue of people, you know, having questions and not being able to be answered. But you also have a specialty or an interest in the aguna issue, you know, women that are in chained marriages. So where did that piece, you know, come into your interest and your work?
So on Instagram, we had this place where people can submit questions. Like I would do it once a month. And people could submit questions and we would research the answer. We would open the sources and we would learn it together online. And one bright morning, I woke up to like maybe 70 inquiries about the Agunas. Like, how does Hashem allow this? How can it be? How is it possible that the Torah that I keep allows me to be abused and it doesn't make any sense and I can't believe in God and I can't trust God? And I was like, whoa. Turns out Dahlia had just posted about like Free Chava and it had woken up so many people to this crisis. And then they were like, one second, I can't keep a religion that puts me in a vulnerable, dangerous situation.
Kayla, can you explain for a second what you're referring to for our listeners who are not familiar with the kind of the details and what is imbalanced about the Torah law around Jewish divorce? And, you know, then we'll talk about what's been done in some communities to help even things out.
So the Torah requires that when a man is no longer with a woman, like no longer sleeping with her, he needs to give her a document that says, I'm no longer sleeping with you. And nowadays that translates into marriage and divorce. And when he's divorcing her, he has to give her a document that says, I'm no longer sleeping with you. You can now sleep with anybody that you want. And the problem that happened over the history of the Jewish people is that men kept on trying to hurt women. I don't think it necessarily came from a place of like men hate women. I think it just culturally, women were really not treated the same that they're treated today. So like as we evolved, the laws had to evolve together with us. And it all kind of stopped evolving about 50 years ago.
So let me also back something up. So the marriage document, the ksuba, that is, you know, how a couple gets married, in its time, it was revolutionary because if you watch the show Les Miserables, you'll see Fantine talk about he slept a summer by my side. He filled my days with endless wonder. He took my childhood in his stride and he was gone when autumn came. So watch that show a few times. So this was not uncommon for a lot of human history for a man and woman to be together, to have a child together, and the man to just, you know, up and leave her alone with the child. So what the ksuba did thousands of years ago was that it said, if you're going to have this type of relationship with a woman, you're going to provide for her now. You're going to provide for her food, clothing, shelter, and there are responsibilities in being intimate with a woman, which was, I would say, in its time, very progressive.
That's not Rabbanim. The ksuba, the having it written on a contract was what the rabbis instituted. But having a man sleeping with a woman from the Torah, he has to provide for her and he has to stay. And then if he wants to leave, he has to provide for the child and her for the rest of their lives, or until they find another man to provide for them. As we progressed in history, and people started saying, promising the world to women and then walking away, that's when the rabbi said, you need to write a contract and there need to be witnesses. You can't just promise and walk away. You have to actually have witnesses and a contract. But now that kind of got turned around on us, because now they're like, fine, then I'm never going to give you the get. Which is halachically usur, because if they're not giving you the get, then they have to provide financially and sexually and physically for you. So, and emotionally. So like the people who aren't giving a get are straight up against the Torah.
Correct. Now, in the times of the Middle Ages, or I would say, I guess, let's back up before that. If a man refused to give a get in an earlier time, the community would compel him to give one or help him come to the right decision. Can you talk a little about, like, sort of the roughing up of recalcitrant husbands as sort of one stage of making?
Yeah. It started later because women didn't leave their husbands, because it was a death sentence to leave your husband, because women couldn't support themselves. So it was really very rare for a woman to request to leave unless her husband was really, really repulsive or abusive. And in those cases, she would go to Beis Din and she would say, I want to leave my husband. And they would hear both sides and they would arbitrate and decide. And if they came to a decision that he has to give her a get, they would say, Chayav legarish, you have to give her a divorce. And you have to give it to her now. And then most of the time he did, because in those days they did follow Beis Din. If he didn't, they would issue a seira. The community would excommunicate him. They wouldn't work with him. They wouldn't count him for a minyan. They wouldn't do any business with him. They wouldn't eat with him. And a lot of times that worked.
And what time period is, are you describing, like Middle Ages?
This is like probably the end of the Gemara. Like
Okay, so
the
500 CE.
So then the what happened was is that we got the Rambam, and they started saying, does a man have to give a get during the time of the Rambam? And the Rambam said, yeah, he has to give a get, because women are not hostages of war, and they don't have to be with anybody they don't want to be with. Jewish women have the choice, and he has to give a get. And then we have a lot of time between the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, where a man who didn't listen to Beis Din and the Seerav didn't affect him, which it did for most men, because of that just meant that you didn't have any like parnasa, because people didn't do business with Jews. Then they had a situation where they came up with the psak of kofimoto, that you can force him until he says, I want to, which basically means you can beat him up until he says, I want to. And they did that for a very long time. But then it became illegal, and we follow the laws of our country. And it stopped being a thing. We didn't really do it anymore. Rav Moshe Feinstein would do it in other ways. He would put pressure on other things, like he would make the guy lose his job, or he would find something that would be more important to him than the get, and he would apply pressure. And if that didn't work, he would find a way to annul the marriage.
So let's talk about also the halachic prenup, because the halachic prenup has done a lot of positive change in terms of evening things out. And you know, to clarify, the prenup actually was written, you know, probably about 40 years ago, the modern version of it. But it started with an idea from Myers and Worms from the Middle Ages, from a document called the Nachla Shiva. You'll correct me if I get anything wrong here, because you're more of an expert than I am. I did dabble in this a little bit because this is on my list of things we have to deal with and fix. If the man was insisting on staying married to this woman in a dead marriage, then the rabbis basically said, well, then you owe her money to support her for, you know, her food and clothing, shelter, that sort of a thing.
You
And
have to
so
fulfill your ksuba. They basically said, if you're not going to give her a get, then you have to fulfill your ksuba.
They would, he would be fined not as a punishment, but just to have to pay what he owed from this document that he is insisting on keeping with her in the marriage. And so this was an old solution for the other means that weren't working. And so when the modern day halachic prenup was written, it was not some new invention, but rather sort of taking an old idea and bringing it out again, fresh and new. In the modern Orthodox world, it is, I mean, I think no one gets married anymore without the halachic prenup being signed. My husband and I got married almost 24 years ago. We did not sign it at the time because we did not have a modern Orthodox rabbi. It was not as popular then. So we actually signed a postnup, which can also be signed. And there are postnup parties where it's the same idea, but you sign it after the fact. And it's not to say that my marriage is bad, just like a prenup is not to say that my marriage is expecting to be bad, but rather to normalize this idea of creating. Well, do you want to explain like what the postnup does now in terms of getting someone some sort of outcome within a secular court?
It doesn't guarantee a get. It just, and that's why people have an issue. People that have an issue with it think that it's a get. Like the people that think that it's a problem are the people that think that it's a get that you're writing that before the wedding, and then the wedding isn't kosher because there's a get written. But what a prenup actually is just you saying like, this is the base din we're going to use. And this is how much money you're going to pay every day until you give a get, just because you're married to me and you have a halachic obligation to support me financially when you're married to me. So you're going to be paying this amount, which is something that's written in the Ksuba thousands of years ago. And you're going to be, we're going to be using this base din, because choosing a base din is usually where a lot of the, you know, struggle is. And it is enforceable in a court of law. So if Beis Din can't do anything and the Seraph isn't doing anything, then you can go to court and you can actually have like capital punishment, like whatever, put them in jail, whatever it is. They can.
Because it's an arbitration agreement that, you know, does have teeth in secular law. And, you know, what I find to be so meaningful and positive about the rabbis finding a modern day solution to this is that instead of just saying, oh, the Torah is not working now, or, you know, rabbis don't care about women, there are many rabbis that deeply care about these issues and are looking to create a system of, you know, we're supposed to follow the law and the Torah, tzedek tir dof, you're supposed to pursue righteousness. And when things are imbalanced and someone is able to harm someone else by manipulating a Torah law, the halachic prenup has been very successful in evening things out. However, like an inoculation,
I want to just say one thing. This mm-hmm. idea that rabbis don't care about women is an idea that has bothered me a lot. I'm surrounded by rabbis, and it bothered me a lot. And I just always say this. It's not that they don't care. It's just that there's so many. The system is broken. There's not enough manpower in the world to actually manage every single person. And this halachic prenup would take out like a huge percentage of the cases, but we do need to deal with this systemically, because it's not that the rabbis don't care. It's just that they're way overloaded and they don't know what to do.
For sure. And not everyone has the right information, and it's hard to start new things. So while the halachic prenup has been very successful in the modern Orthodox world, by definition, the Haredi world is trying to change less quickly in order to preserve tradition, because, you know, Jewishness has been lost. There has been assimilation. There has been, you know, a loss of tradition in much of the Jewish world. And so, I mean, like what you referenced earlier with the Enlightenment, with the Reform movement starting, that only pushed people on the other side to dig in their heels deeper and say, if this side is changing so quickly, then we will change less quickly. So where are we now in terms of the work that you're doing? So we have, you know, it's not a perfect solution, but the halachic prenup seems to be very effective, but it's less used in the Haredi circles. So tell us about this asifa that you're organizing and what you've done in the past.
So we did an asifa in the past, which raised awareness to the rabbinic world. And most, it's I would say 50-50 modern Orthodox and Haredi and Hasidish. And it raised awareness. And at this point, we have a committee, we have rabbis, we have cooperation with rabbis for every case that needs for the jurisdiction or whatever. But at this point, we realized that most cases could have been nipped in the bud if they would have been dealt with correctly from the get-go. And that once a case escalates, the rabbi doesn't know what to do. And when we reach out to them, they're very hesitant to get involved. It's a very politically charged topic. They don't really understand. There's two sides. There's usually someone threatening them and they just don't want to get involved. So we created a rabbi's asifa, which is inviting rabbis to come to an online summit that will have keynote leading speakers like the chief rabbi of Israel and the head of the Bad, Rabbi Ullman, and my father will be there, but we have a lot of really well-known speakers speaking to the rabbis to educate them what to do to avoid igun, like the prenup, what to do when a couple comes to them talking about divorce, how to guide them through it, and what to do if a case does escalate, and creating kind of this central system so that nobody's shouldering it alone and nobody's saying, I don't want to get involved. Like, we're all in this together. We're all going to fix this together. And one community at a time will make it safe for women to get married.
And when is this taking place?
It's April 7th at 1 p.m.
Online.
And it's online. And there's a link that you can register and you can do it from home. And it's really, really simple and easy and free. So
But this is rabbis only we're inviting. We're not inviting our listeners.
only rabbis. But what I've been asking people to do is to reach out to their rabbis, because me reaching out to their rabbi means a lot less than somebody in their community telling them this is important to me. And we've had a lot more success that way. And thank God we have 120 rabbis signed up from around the world. So it's going to hopefully be a big change.
What, first of all, it's amazing and you should be so proud. And what I love about, I mean, I see myself as a woman that's kind of like moving the needle and seeing a problem and going, you know, just diving in and trying to make it better. And I see you as someone with sort of that similar vision of like, why can't it be me? This needs to
How hard
happen.
can
Yeah.
it be?
But what do you say?
The how hard can it be, Jean?
Yeah, it's a how hard can it be? But also like, no one told me I couldn't do this. And, you know, I think both of us have had a lot of positive reception from rabbis who, again, we are told are so mean, are so scary, don't want to do anything good. But look, there are extremists out there. There are people that are not coming from the right place, but there's also a lot of good ones that just need someone to kind of stir things up and say, I have a plan, let's get started. And I think that story is never told. So really, kol hakavod for, you know, stirring things up and moving things along here. What's the goal? What is the dream when this asifa is over? And then what is the goal when your work in this space will be over? And then I can check that off my list too.
Want to create a central authoritative committee so that the VOD is a central authoritative committee that every rabbi can say, I'm going to do whatever the VOD says. The VOD arbitrates, the VOD listens to both sides. The VOD told us that this is the right thing to do, and we trust the VOD. And the VOD is comprised of leading rabbanim from around the world. And that way, any gut refuser that exists in the world would have nowhere to run, because the VOD would be touching every community. Eventually, the goal is to just figure out some kind of solution to avoid this problem to begin with, but I don't think we're going to be there for another few years. I think for
Okay,
now,
because the
the
other thing that we didn't mention is that one of the reasons why the old solutions don't work like they used to is that we're not in this sort of like small town system anymore. People can really up and leave and go far away and sort of reinvent themselves. So with technology, the world has gotten smaller. So there hopefully should be a way to make sure that these get refusers have no place to run and no place to hide and that they can't continue to
I'll tell
violate
you what, it
the
would
system.
solve 99% of them, and then the 1% will shine so brightly that we'll have to figure out a solution for them. But right now they're getting mixed up in the murkiness. So we need to first isolate them, and this will do
Okay,
that.
well, call your rabbi. You can have him register. We'll include a link. And Kayla, thank you for your amazing work. And you should go Michael El Chayil.
Thank you so much.
And thanks so much for listening. You can catch us same time, same place next week. Bye-bye.